amazing episode of the No Franchise Fatigue Movie Podcast, where we leap down the rabbit hole of cinematic franchises, no matter how many sequels, prequels, remakes, reboots, reimaginings, or remakels are included. My name is Matt Reifschneider, and I am joined once again by my co-host and friend, Mr. Kaler. How are you this afternoon, Mr. Kaler?
My name is Betty, you son of a bitch.
Oh, wow. You're referencing two movies in one joke. One joke, two movies.
That's the kind of quality you get when I'm back. Fresh new reboot, reloaded.
Yeah, reloaded. I think we could go with reloaded for this. So, hello and welcome back to another time-flexing episode of No French. Wait, I'm sorry. Sorry, I had a bout of deja vu. Maybe that's because we're talking about an incredibly influential franchise this week. One that has been fan requested, and one that is suddenly very relevant.
Right, so yes. Because we went on hiatus because I went to programming school, and now that I am professionally a hacker, we're talking about The Matrix, and for literally no other reason. Certainly no trailers came out.
No, there wasn't a trailer last week. Not that I can remember. It almost feels like I took a blue pill regards to it.
As of time of recording, jokes aside, the Matrix 4 trailer did come out right as we were planning this kind of fresh comeback, and we were just like, oh, we got it. It's serendipity, really.
Right. We've got to hack the code, right? We've got to wake up, Sean. Wake up. Mm-hmm. That's what we got to do. So wake up, Neil. Follow the white rabbit.
But before any of the fun parts, got a little business to attend to. Isn't that right, Agent Reifschneider?
Yes.
You know, because
absolutely.
Because they went with the common last names, right? So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So Reifschneider makes sense.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. That's how that works. You're absolutely right, Sean. We do have to take care of some business. So if you like what you hear today, please check out our expanding back catalog wherever you listen to your podcasts on anchor.fm, Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or YouTube. And while you're there, rate, review, and subscribe. And if you love what we do here, you can also help us out a little bit and keep the lights on by joining us on Patreon. Yes, that's right. We are launching our No Franchise Fatigue Extended Cuts over on Patreon on October 1st. So please subscribe to our social media for when that goes live and enjoy a ton of bonus content, including lost episodes, film commentaries, and a lot of other cool stuff that we're going to be putting on there. We have two levels to join us at, but you know, you can always support NFF cause by just sharing our podcast and telling a friend. So please join us over on the Patreon. We would love to see you over there. Be one of our franchisees. What should we call our fans? I don't know if we've ever come to an agreement on that.
I actually kind of like franchisees. Definitely want to check out our Patreon, especially some cool exclusive content, including me and Matt trapped in a room with a haunted projector that plays movies and makes us feel everything the characters are going through on screen.
I mean, we've actually been there before. We actually have to go back to record. That's the worst part. Because we were like,
Devil's Rejects was a rough choice.
Devil's Rejects is a rough choice. But yes, absolutely. We're going to be launching the Hall of No Fatigue over on the Patreon. So definitely check us out over at Extended Cuts. When that launches October 1st, you guys will be able to join us there. So enough about us, though, because we are going to be talking about The Matrix today. And as always, we're going to be splitting up this franchise. There's four films that we're going to be covering in this series, which includes The Matrix, The Matrix Reloaded, The Matrix Revolutions, and of course the kind of spin-off film, The Animatrix. So we're going to be talking about The Matrix today from 1999, and we're going to be talking about 2003's The Animatrix. Now, I know you guys are like, what the fuck are you guys doing? It is not in chronological order this time. Well, maybe we just felt like we should change up the structure of it a little bit and talk about The Animatrix now, partially because it serves somewhat as a prequel going into The Matrix Reloaded.
And the argument could be made that, albeit the majority of the shorts were seen for the first time on this DVD, four of them were released on the website leading up to the second movie as marketing, including the kind of keystone sequence Final Flight of the Osiris, which we'll talk about when we get there. But Final Flight was actually shockingly easy to see that summer. God, I think it was playing before a couple of movies, and
yep,
I think there were actually showings of The Matrix Reloaded that ran it beforehand.
Yeah, it wouldn't shock me. I mean, we'll talk a lot about the marketing for these films in general as we kind of go through this franchise. So yeah, if you guys are wondering why we're not doing it in chronological order, technically, yes, that's kind of why, that was kind of how we justified it. Not to mention, The Matrix Reloaded and Revolutions are basically one film. So it's just easier to kind of analyze those ones together. Similar to what we did with Rurouni Kenshin. That's why we didn't split up those series until this new fourth and fifth one, which, you know, put a pin in that one.
Yep.
We got that one coming up. So.
I think.
Nonetheless, if you haven't seen The Matrix or The Animagic, please feel free to stop the podcast now and watch them wherever you watch films. I believe they're on HBO Max with a subscription if you wanted to do that, or anywhere that you watch movies, because we are going to be talking spoilers today for movies that are almost, one's over 20 years old, and the other one will be almost 20 years old at this point. So if you don't want spoilers for The Matrix, which, how you've avoided that, you're dodging bullets like this Neo is, over there.
Yeah, this is like I Am Your Father level of like deep cultural impact. I truly, and again, we still have a segment to go before we really touch on all this, but I truly, honestly, in my life mark cinema as before and after The Matrix came out, because it literally changed everything.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I think in a cultural zeitgeist way, you're absolutely right. But we'll get to that in a second. As you mentioned, Sean, we do have one more segment to tackle right before we get into talking about The Matrix. And that is, we are going to be going through NFF Destroys All Movies. All right, Sean. So, now that we've had that musical cue that was put in there by the magic of a hacker, with a green screen.
I literally hacked it into the timeline. Yeah.
You hacked it into the timeline. What have you been watching lately?
So it kind of a funny question, cause you know, we have been on break so long. I really could have chosen anything I've seen over the last, you know, couple months. But I got a little Blu-ray in the mail literally just yesterday and immediately had to watch it. And that was the Arrow 4K restoration of the David Lynch seminal classic 1984's Dune. Oh my God. I can't even begin to express like how beautiful this transfer is. It's all from the original film negative and everything. So it's like actual true 4K. It's gorgeous.
You got the official 4K one?
The actual, not just the... which I was nervous for a second because the disc says that it's Region B only, but it played my PlayStation 5, so I'm going to call it good.
No, and that's my understanding is Arrow sent me a review copy of the new 4K for Dune. I just haven't had a chance to dig into it yet. But it's usually when Arrow has something that's releasing worldwide, it doesn't matter. All the regions, basically make it all region.
My love for David Lynch and my love for, frankly, this version of Dune is already well noted. I'm very, very excited for the new version, so I'm instead going to take my time to take a step back and complain at Arrow Video. All of your 4K UHD stuff, all of it, is international except the super special edition of Battle Royale. You bastards.
Because yeah, the regular
4K is international, but Battle Royale 2, BR2 Requiem, has never had a Western release, or at least west of the UK.
Well, it did. It was available in that box set, because I have it.
Really? They did a USA release of BR2?
They did. But it is.
I figured that had to be what was holding it up, because I can't think of anything in the original that would. Well, no, I mean, because they do have the international version of the UHD of Battle Royale. So I don't know. It's weird.
I have the box set that's got 1, 2, and then like whatever the director's cut, the dream cut, if you want to call it that, of Battle Royale and stuff like that. So I have that box set that was the US release, but I think that's even out of print now.
Yeah.
And I don't know which company has the rights to Battle
Royale. And
I'm
deeply tempted to pick up the 4K anyway, because BR2 Requiem's the garbage movie at best, outside of that hilarious scene where the teacher decides to join the students rushing the compound and then blows up literally immediately. But Battle Royale 1, I actually prefer the theatrical cut of it before they added all the digital blood in that weird director's special version. So I would actually just like to have a physical copy of the theatrical of Battle Royale 1.
Now that I think about it, I think all 4K discs are technically region free.
Hmm. That'd be interesting.
And so I'm guessing the region that's on there might be the special, like,
special features discs. That would make sense. Mm. Which I,
now that I'm thinking about it, because like I've bought 4Ks from other places, and they're always, they don't have any region coding on it, because I don't think there's any region coding for any 4Ks.
But enough about me ranting. Region codes shouldn't be a thing anyway. Anyway, never should have been. It's pure economic capitalism at its worst.
Well, I mean, come on. You want these people to get paid for their stuff, so
I do. I do, and that's fair, but at the same time, they are getting paid because I'm buying a DVD from a region they did legally produce it in.
Oh, that's true. And I guess they are getting paid.
I am in no way advocating piracy. I'm absolutely advocating a lack of borders on my goddamn DVDs.
We are advocating for all region Blu-ray players.
Bingo. Yeah. Boy, that's true.
That's
too.
What I have. So that's what I have. So
I just have my PlayStation. Great. All right. But yeah, so that's my little rant. But the Dune 4K, big A-OK for me, looks gorgeous. Honestly, Sting has never looked more glorious. Kyle MacLachlan's hair has never been more just woof.
Right. Woof.
Yeah. Riding Shad Halud.
Gotta love it. Gotta love it. I'm
How about yourself?
I'm excited to dig into 4K, but I have not watched it yet. So, but what I have watched in the last couple of weeks, I want to make a throw out a shout out to the new Netflix original film, Kate. That's the first one I want to throw a shout out to, because and this is one of those things that recently I've seen a lot of these movies that go to these straight to streamings and stuff to kind of get like middling reviews. When they get released through like Letterboxd and things like that. And Kate's one of those films. It was kind of like getting pretty lukewarm reception where people are like, it's fine. It looks good. And that's it. And then I had a chance to kind of partake in it this last weekend or whatever. I loved Kate. I thought it was a blast. So this is going to be one of those films that I will die on the hill for. I think it is a gorgeous film, cinematography, directorial wise.
So many people have the guts to bemoan the death of the mid-range action film, and then they're going to bash a movie like Kate, which, frankly, you can tell, didn't have a huge budget. Every cent of it is on screen, and I think it's all fairly well spent, because the action's very good. You know, I'm not trying to step all over your toes here.
No,
but
you're good.
On the strength of your review at bloodbrothersfilms.com. I actually did check this out myself and quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, I thought it was a blast. It's 8711, who are now referred to as 87 North Productions. So they're the ones that were kind of making this film and everything. So you know the action is going to be strong. It's part of that new wave of neon-soaked action films, those mid-budget action films, in the wake of John Wick that you're seeing a lot of. And I just got to throw out a shout-out for that and so make my defense of the movie Kate. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Don't miss the chance to point out a really, really fun performance from Mary Elizabeth Winstead and really fun performance from Woody Harrelson.
Oh, yeah. Great. Fantastic stuff in there. And obviously a secondary cast of some very, very popular Japanese actors you'll recognize if you are a fan of Japanese cinema that make appearances in this movie. So, all right, that's kind of all I have for films that I've watched. So why don't we get jacked in and let's download ourselves over into The Matrix. The Matrix, 1999. Just throwing it up out front because this film, as you had noted earlier, is considered a seminal classic at this point. And I think it's safe to say, not even say modern classic, it's safe to say classic. This film is now 20 years old, so I think we can definitely make that claim on there. But just to go over some of the numbers on this for the critic response on Rotten Tomatoes, you're looking at an 88%. For the audience response, you're looking at an 85%, which I feel like are both a little low. What do you think, Sean?
Yeah, they're both excruciatingly low to me, actually. I think This is one of those movies that has proven over and over again over the course of 20 years that it's actually smarter the more you go back and look at it. And that's a very rare trait.
I absolutely agree. And in fact, it's when you kind of sold me on this idea of like us doing the Matrix and kind of response to our comeback and the release of the trailer for the Matrix Resurrections, I was a little bit hesitant because these are films that have been analyzed to death. Mm-hmm. And the first one in particular, like I actually just read an article a couple days ago in doing my research on the Matrix and stuff like that on all of the trans text that exists in the Matrix. And that's fascinating read.
If I can make a quick note on that, like trans subtext, just like the gay subtext in Nightmare on Elm Street 2, it's just there. Whether the writer intended it to be there or not, it is just there. And if you're the kind of person that actually changes the movie for you in any functional way, then for one, you need to learn what the sub and subtext means. And for two, like, come on, are you kidding me right now? Yeah. To be a transphobe in the year of 2021, are you kidding me? Anyway, so that aside, yes, especially from a looking back perspective, this movie is so trans and queer coded that it is sashaying down a rainbow road, and I completely love it because it shows they're just badass. They're all heroes. They're all like super cool, sexy hackers, and
yeah, right. It's a film that is, and kind of going into that point, that you can watch it in 99, miss all of that, and it works. You can watch it in 2021, get all of the layers, and that's just one of the many layers in these films, right? Oh. So particularly this first one that you can really just dig into. And I think that that's really, as you mentioned, its strength as a film. Now, I don't want to sit here and just analyze the Matrix. We're really going to talk about the franchise, right? And kind of how this kicks off a franchise and take a look at what this kind of means as a franchise. But I think that that's super important to even discuss right up front, is that like there is so much analysis that you can do. There's so many layers in this.
Well, because the trans narrative has caught on so much, and I'm actually glad, you know, trans people deserve their movie, that people lose track of the fact that this is also very, very, very deeply an anti-capitalism film too.
Yeah.
Like that's that's not even subtext. That's a theme of the movie.
A pretty regular one, and this movie has a lot of themes that we can dig into, and I guess maybe even before we dig into that, and I just wanted to be upfront about like our approach and analysis is going to be more from a franchise standpoint than necessarily a philosophical standpoint.
Or yeah, the plot and where it stands as a franchise and like its legacy and all that stuff. That's more a purview. Plus, We're just two like white cis guys. I'm certainly not the best person to talk about the trans aspects of it, but it doesn't take much research, and there are a lot of great video essays, a lot of great articles,
scholarly absolutely academic stuff out there,
and yeah. Simulation theory on just this movie touches on so much.
It does, and I think that it would be poor choice of ours to not indicate to our audience and our listeners that you should really go check out. If you haven't gone back to read this analysis now, then go back and read it, because not only should you revisit this film with the new one coming out, but really dig into it and kind of learn a lot about how people see this, because this movie is all about perception, not only as a theme in the film itself, right, about a perception of reality, but it's one that converts well.
Our purview is exploitation cinema, which this movie is not, but it does reference very, very much, especially in the realms of kung fu and anime, and that is certainly our realm.
Oh, for sure. This is a movie that takes all of that, balls it up, and then throws it. And for some wild reason, it stuck, even in 99. Because this is it should be mentioned that in 1999, the industry was much different than it is even now. And the studios were greenlighting a lot of interesting stuff, particularly in the summer of 99. So many great movies come out in this era, and The Matrix kind of destroys them all.
But we're still in the preamble, because Good stuff. We should probably at some point say, what is the Matrix?
Oh, yes. What is the Matrix, which was the key portion of the marketing for this movie, was the mystery behind what is the Matrix. So
what we have is a movie where a man working at a drone-like job, staying up all night as a hacker on kind of the black market, is also searching for a wanted terrorist, Morpheus. When he discovers Morpheus, Morpheus tells him, "You were never really looking for me. You were looking for the truth to a question you've always known. What is the Matrix?" And pulls Neo out, where he discovers that the Matrix is in fact a giant mental prison used to keep the human race pacified, as we are used for our bioelectricity to power machines, because we nuked the crap out of the sun during some long ago war, and it's kind of our ironic punishment forever. And so this hacker, Neo by name, like anybody here doesn't know that, discovers that not only is the world he knew fake, but he is in fact robot Jesus and the prophesied messiah that will save the humans from the robots. So he has to basically train up and go fight against a machine system with superpowers. That's the most basic synopsis, but I mean, again, who are we kidding? Everybody has seen The Matrix. Everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. Throwing down a synopsis. Plus, as we said, it's a very layered film. So, with that. So, but thank you for that synopsis, Sean, and everything. So, and going through it. So,
well, because, you know, we're touching on a, let's just hit the layers we find most important. Cause like for me, I think, very much the cyberpunk narrative of this is very, very important. This is very much point by point a cyberpunk movie, down to hackers versus an oppressive government. Governments created by machines and enslaving us in a VR world, but still nonetheless. And then, obviously, I'm just a big fan of the kind of pop culture comic book anime layer of this. Right. I'll certainly let you tackle the kung fu, although I like it. You know it a hell of a lot better than I do.
Well, and that's what's, and certainly that's the big selling point. Even back in 1999, that was a big selling point for me. And part of what I really enjoy about The Matrix, especially as a franchise Kickstarter, is that it essentially is three films rolled into one, which is a really fascinating kind of asset to the film. The first part, being the first act, is borderline a mystery film. It's almost noirish. Had you had a narrator in it, like, there would have been like this noir kind of angle to it that I really do appreciate. The second half is your big sci-fi, right? Once you get out of the Matrix and you're back into the real world and he's kind of learning everything and getting jacked in.
Before you brush past that, and I do want to know what your third film is, but before you brush past that, as far as a narrative hook as to why a character goes from zero to knowing, you know, every hand-to-hand combat art, that being able to install it into someone's brain like a program, boy, Wachowski's knocked one out of the park with that one.
Well, and talk about a way to fill in any plot holes, right? Like, if you want to complain that how would James Bond know how to drive a Soviet tank in GoldenEye, right? Like,
well, how does Trinity know how to fly a helicopter?
Yeah, she literally loads it up, right? And so, like, no, it is a great kind of sci-fi kind of element to it, where you're kind of laying the groundwork, but you're creating two worlds in this dual worlds, the Matrix world and then the real world, right? Which, of course, we're being told a lot of information, which we're not even sure is true or not, which is a big theme in this movie, is about that perception of reality. And then, of course, the third act of this is a straightforward gun-fu action film, highly influenced by the works of John Woo or Ringo Lam, and of course that's my big selling point on this whole franchise, is that element. As a franchise starter for The Matrix, is that I think the Wachowskis do a fantastic job at pulling a lot of influences, particularly of foreign cinema, and then incorporating it into a way that really sells itself as a Hollywood action film. And I think it's brilliant in how they kind of lay that out. And they've created this world that you can really explore for later entries.
Well, because to me, what's I think what's kind of cool about what they did here, kind of expanding on your point, is that, you know, you've created a world where you can have just any kind of insane action sequence you want, and it's completely feasible. It's not something they explore as much in these movies as they could have, but it's very feasible for there to have been a cabin in the woods scenario. You could say one of the Animatrix shorts, we'll get there when we get there, but actually touches on this idea, a haunted house within the Matrix. You know, there are a lot of, there are werewolves in these movies. There's ghosts, goddammit, in the sequel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. It does allow for a lot of interesting paths that it could take, which is maybe why, for as much work that The Matrix does in terms of creating this world, it's almost a shame it hasn't been explored more. Mm. As a franchise, we've only gotten 4 films, one of them being what we're talking about next in the anime.
And a fair tome of comics, but, like, who really sought those out? And they haven't been republished very often.
No, it's really fascinating that you created this world, then you don't really explore it. Because you could have easily, as you said, if you're able to bend the limits of using computer logic or whatever, bend the rules of a world that way, you easily could have made this like an X-Men movie, where certain people have different abilities to bend the Matrix at different willpower, right? And Neo being like, if you, for lack of a better term, a Superman, well, or anything like
that. And actually kind of to bring it back into the movie as opposed to kind of what could have been.
You know, and they do this fantastic job in regards to that. And so they're pulling a lot of old influences and kind of remixing it, if you will, into kind of this new film, and then really pushing the limits on technology and visual fun stuff. And as you indicated, like, there's a lot of anime influence on here, and I feel like that comes across in a lot of the visual stuff that they're attempting to do.
Yeah, if I can touch on that real quick, because a lot of why the kung fu works is they brought in, like, professional kung fu teams. You know, that's more your area of expertise. But I feel a lot of that, why that works, is they took the time to actually send the actors in and train them like they would have in Hong Kong cinema. The actors are expected to do at least X amount of the stunts themselves.
Yep.
But I think that some kind of special call out to the Wachowski siblings as visual directors, because there's a difference between a reference shot and doing a shot for shot kind of remake. This is not that weird Gus Van Sant Psycho. This is not the weird, you know, Ghost in the Shell movie where they're copying a lot of action sequences, but they don't understand the strengths of animation and the strengths of live action. This movie understood the strengths of effects, the strengths of live action, and the strengths of pre-visualization and making sure things looked cool in live action. They reference these anime shots to the point where it's like, yeah, he stops a shell in midair with his mind. But they did it in a way that looked good in live action, and that is not an insignificant talent. And the Wachowskis have proven this over and over and over again. Say what you will about Jupiter Ascending. I love it. Everybody else hated it. But boy, the action's crazy. You got frickin' Magic Mike McWolfboy running on frickin' air, shooting guns while hanging out with the one movie Sean B-Man Bean survives. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, you could tell she was royalty. Because of the bees.
The bees.
Because of the bees, Sean. Because of the bees. That's how you could tell. No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. There's not a lost in translation element that's going on with this film. And as you mentioned, the kung fu element of it is obviously Yu Wuping is going to be the action choreographer for this. They had to really convince him to come on board to do the martial arts segments to it. Obviously, he's very well versed in wire fu, using the wires to create that wuxia element of people who are able to bend the elements just due to their will, right? Which is something that's obviously a big portion of the Matrix and a key part of this film. But also, like, it's interesting that this film was a cultural standpoint because of that translation. Mm-hmm. They were just taking things that were maybe popular elsewhere and suddenly made it popular in the U.S. This idea of a guy in, you know, a black duster with sunglasses shooting up, you know, the front end of a office building is not new. It just made it popular here. That is something that John Woo did with Chow Yun-fat in A Better Tomorrow, right? That is, I mean...
It's something in comics that Grant Morrison did with the Invisibles in Scotland in the 90s.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, like, yeah, it's they're just taking these elements, remixing it, translating it, and I mean... Tip the hat to Warner Brothers for greenlighting this movie to begin with, because I can't imagine reading the script and being like, oh yeah, let's give him $60 million.
And let's never forget, off of the strength of Bound, they pitched this crazy giant original IP comic book movie. Joel Silver loved it. WB was like, no way in hell we're giving this to unproven directors. So they went out and proved themselves by making this weird little indie lesbian heist movie that is, by the way, wonderful. I don't mean to underplay how great Bound is. Jennifer Tilly and Gina Gershon just... killer in that movie. Anyway, aside the point, off of this no budget, you know, lesbian heist thriller, all of a sudden they got greenlit for huge sci-fi blockbuster tentpole. It's insane.
And for an unproven IP too. Mm-hmm. Like this is almost something you don't see anymore in terms of these kinds of risks that studios were taking in the 90s, as I mentioned at the beginning, for the summer of 99, where you get films like Fight Club and these kind of weird unconventional hits of that era. 98
and 99 were both really good years for tentpoles.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. It was just, and I think it was just studios didn't understand what was going to be popular next. So they were just kind of green lighting whatever seemed interesting. And if it stuck, it stuck. The Matrix stuck, you know, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the cast going into this, because I think the cast adds a lot of gravitas and gives the film a lot of legs in terms of creating that
franchise.
About
to say, we can talk about the directors and we can talk about the action. We can talk about all this stuff, but... You know, Keanu, everyone's said a lot about Keanu over the years. Everybody loves Carrie Ann Moss. I truly do not believe this movie works without Lawrence Fishburne. He was not the original idea for Morpheus either, but this movie does not work without Lawrence Fishburne, and this movie does not work, completely collapses, 100% falls apart without Hugo Weaving. Hugo Weaving is the MVP of this film and of this franchise, and I will die on that hill.
Yeah, I would agree that there's a lot of interesting elements at play here with the cast, and we don't have to go super in-depth in this because, again, all of this has been analyzed to death before, but I do think that a special mention should be given to Lawrence Fishburne, who's adding a lot of gravitas to this film in terms of being that instantly charismatic
leader. Yeah, because Neo's not the heart of this movie. Neo is barely a video game character. He barely has a personality, you know. His personality is defined by everybody else's relationship to him. He's defined by Trinity's love for him. He's defined by being the one that Morpheus has been seeking the whole time, but in and of himself, he does not have much in the way of character traits.
This movie's obsessed with mirrors. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of mirror shots, use of mirrors in it, and things like that. Again, this movie's a lot about perception of reality, and a mirror is a very interesting reflection, right? And I think that that's what's really interesting about the character Neo is, as you say, he's very much a reflection of the characters around him, more so than anything else. You know, it's the savior we need, not the savior that he is. Yeah. Right. And so, like, there's a lot of interesting kind of play there. And I think Keanu Reeves does that really well in this movie. He plays that very, very well. But, you know, I think the secondary cast really does carry it. As you mentioned, Hugo Weaving adds such a weird, sinister element to a person who essentially has no personality, and you only get to see it in little bits as the movie goes on. So by the end, when he pulls his headset out to have that personal conversation with Morpheus, it really has impact.
I think that that's really just good. Watching a video essay today, kind of prepping for this, from a YouTuber named Ben from Canada. Certainly don't want to steal his idea here, but where he says that interview scene is one of the greatest scenes in, you know, villain monologue history. For the exact reason that we've seen over and over again that this is a machine. We know he's just a construct. He's a conscious algorithm, for all intents and purposes. But he's had a few weird tics, and this is the moment where you realize, oh, they're sentient. They're just like us. He's a dude that hates his job. Right. And he's racist. He's literally racist against humans. You know, he's definitely coded as a transphobe. He's dead naming Neo.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely, right? In as you said, Hugo Weaving's performance here is incredible. His way of enunciating, like over-enunciating, where he doesn't sound like a robot, but he sounds like he's like doesn't quite have a grasp on the language. And I think that that's such an interesting... It sounds
like he's explaining everything to a child. Like he's John Malkovich and somebody got his order wrong at a restaurant. Look, I said I ordered the Caesar salad with no chicken.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. That's absolutely true. And I think that that's such a brilliant part of this movie. And so I think that kind of covers up a lot of what we wanted to talk about here. You know, it's also one of those movies that I feel like there's so many layers to it that a lot of people sometimes misread it. Mm-hmm. You know, because I know a lot of conspiracy theorists that love to quote the Matrix on things, and that kind of also hurts my soul a little bit.
It's one of the reasons I'm so glad this fourth movie's coming out. Take back that red pill quote.
Yeah, exactly. Take it back. So it should be mentioned that this movie is, because of its layers, can also be kind of read in some interesting ways that I don't necessarily agree with either. But it also shows just how versatile it is, and it perfectly lays the groundwork.
Well, because at the same time, it's also very, very easy to side with the fascist in this movie, which is Agent Smith. Like, you know, if you're the type of... Because he's sympathetic if you're the type of personality that wants things orderly and does want things to just kind of... Everybody goes into their little boxes. I could see Smith actually being a sympathetic character if that was your worldview.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And also, like, it's influential.
And everybody feels like the rebel. Everybody feels like they're the rebellion. So anytime you have rebellious characters, people are going to feel like it's them.
Absolutely, right? And that's problematic sometimes. Mm. And I think also, like, in a cultural standpoint, the popularity of The Matrix also led to a lot of people who were, or even studios, trying to pull elements of it and not understanding why those work. Mm-hmm. As we, in one of our earlier episodes, talked about in Charlie's Angels, why the action just seems so cartoonish is because there's no reason for it, even though you're just ripping off The Matrix. And that happens a lot with films kind of post, as you indicated before. I think we might have been off mic.
When we get to the sequels, as much as I love and defend the sequels, even they're guilty of that a tiny bit.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think we even said it kind of off mic, but you had kind of said you, and maybe you said this on mic, maybe I'm just repeating myself. So, you had kind of said that you kind of relegate action cinema as kind of pre-Matrix, post-Matrix. And I think that that's absolutely true. It is such a kind of a cultural cornerstone of cinema at the time that you can see kind of the ripple effect even to this
what movie. One joke defined every single parody movie of the early aught.
Bullet Time is just it's, you know, and don't get me wrong, like, that was fucking cool at the time where you're like, I didn't understand how they did it.
Even our precious Kung Pao.
Yeah, even our precious Kung Pao did do a Bullet Time reference. And you know, it's the Scary Movies did the Bullet Time reference. You named it. Everybody did it. I'm pretty sure Shrek did it. Yep. So you couldn't get away from it for a while. So
at least Shrek made fun of the Trinity Kick. That was different.
Oh, that's true. That's right. That's what they did in that one. So, yeah, there you go. So, there is a dark side to all this, too. So,
yes, trucking right along. That did seem a little scattered because there is so much you could talk about with the original Matrix, but we are also focused on films as franchise. And unfortunately, The Matrix is also, like, singularly perfect. It's a great setup and a great open world for other people to kind of play in, but as a singular narrative, it never even needed a sequel. It's kind of just this perfect little thing.
It is, and it ends on that note, and I think that that's... It's one of those kind of lost arts in the cinematic franchise, is making a film that could stand on its own and yet does so much world building that you could build off of it without being so obvious, right? There's threads that are left open, but they're not there, which is something that, like, at this point, like, don't get me wrong, you know, I enjoy the MCU as much as Joe Schmo down the street, but, like, there's so much, like, world building that is just so ham-fisted in that it to the point it's kind of like, just make a good movie and then take that and then build on it. You don't have to set up 20,000 threads as you go. And I think The Matrix is perfect at getting that balance.
Blast some rage against the machine. Neo flies at the camera. And then tell us, what is our second film for the night?
So we are going to be moving into the Animatrix from 2003. As you noted before, it was a big part of the marketing push initially for The Matrix Reloaded. And so, and enough so that even, like, elements of it were released in 2003. Other parts were in 2004. So even the year can be kind of a questionable area for this. But so let's talk about the Animatrix. The Animatrix is a series of small vignettes built together as a standalone release. All of these short films are put together. They all tell singular stories about The Matrix. Most of them were Japanese creators, although we do have a couple of Americans that are involved in this process and things like that. But a lot of it was sent over to the anime studios to animate this animated film, if you want. I'm going to say animate another 3,000 times in response to this movie with it to get it together. So we, as you noted in the beginning, we will kind of talk about these segments kind of separately from each other as we go. So I don't know if giving a synopsis outside of the build of this film being an anthology is really necessary on it. Now, I will say this film was not released for critics because it didn't technically get a theatrical release until later. Is that correct? Now I'm questioning.
I don't think it ever did, in fact.
Yeah. I think
Final Flight of the Osiris got some theatrical play, but I don't think the whole thing as a unit ever has. Not that I'm aware of, anyway.
Yeah, and so that's why we don't have a critic score on Rotten Tomatoes. And even the fan score, the people who saw it, the audience score is only a 62% on the Animatrix, which is, again, a little bit a little bit light than I expected, but I guess I get that
one. It actually makes more sense, I think, because I think a lot more... This is a lot. The Animatrix is a lot. Because, for one, it started the trend of Warner Brothers doing things like this. There's also a Green Lantern, I think it's called Emerald Knights, that's kind of like this.
Gotham Knight.
There's a Batman anime that's exactly like this. Exactly, yeah.
Yep. So, yeah, Warner Brothers had their kind of foot in this. And it's very interesting to see this, because you could tell that... My guess is Warner Brothers is like, yeah, we understand there's a lot of anime influence in The Matrix, and we kind of want to capitalize on this, but we are not sure how American audiences will respond to it.
It was also ballsy enough to kind of let people actually do their own thing and play with The Matrix as a playground. The only things the Wachowskis really have a toe in are the two that directly link to the sequel, which is... and we should just start going through these, but the two that directly link would be Final Flight of the Osiris and Kid's Story.
Yep. And it should be noted at the beginning of this movie, at least on my Blu-ray, there is a warning that says this animated film is not for children, pretty sternly, which is pretty...
We will throw up the same trigger warning. One of these stories does involve suicide, that's a factor.
Yep, it's a pretty interesting and heavy series, as you said, of different companies kind of taking their stab at it. But and you noted this when we were talking off mic when we were watching this, that my version of this does open up with the Osiris story. Yours did not.
Mine closes with Final Flight of the Osiris. I was watching the Vudu digital version, and yeah, I don't know. I don't think it really affects anything. We can certainly start with Final Flight. It's how every version I've ever seen it starts. But just a weird note, the Vudu version ends with Final Flight of the Osiris for some reason.
I would note, because when you told me that, I'm like, I have a lot of thoughts on this. I think that that's stupid that you would close the movie out. I get, you know, maybe you want to say like, hey, maybe it's the best segment. You want to close out with it or whatnot. And saying that it's the best is obviously an opinion, right? But
not a good one either.
What I like about I agree. We'll talk about that later. But I think opening it up with Flight of the Osiris makes more sense because you are reacclimating people into the Matrix world by saying like, here is like a segment that has both elements of the Matrix and the real world. It gets that balance there, and it tells a story that's intrinsically connected to the Matrix Reloaded, a point where in the beginning of Matrix Reloaded they refer to the Osiris and its destruction, and so that you get to see that in this
moment. You know what just occurred to me? I know exactly why they do it. Because now, when you watch them, when you do it marathon as you do, Final Flight of the Osiris is actually the last segment you'd want to see before rolling into Reloaded.
Fair enough. When you're watching it as a franchise. I guarantee you
that's exactly why they did it.
Yeah, and it's funny because I have the... It's not like a new Blu-ray box set, but it was a box set, the nice one, the Ultimate Matrix Collection.
But they're
box.
Still going to reprint exactly how they put it out
the disc. Yeah, absolutely. So, but anyway, nonetheless, I just wanted to make that point that I think it's stupid, and I'm going to stand by it. I'm going to die on that hill because I hate stupidity and I think it's stupid. So,
all right, well, first things first, we'll go into Final Flight of the Osiris. So, this is the one done by Square Pictures. It is literally the only other thing Square Pictures ever produced besides Pop Quiz.
Final Fantasy.
Spirits Within, that's exactly right. Studio collapsed immediately after this for reasonable reason. This animation does not hold up well at all.
Oh, I see, and I like
it. It looks like CGI a PS2 cutscene.
It does look like a PS2 cutscene, but I don't mind it.
But that said, the story is the reason we're able to do the synopsis for all of these is these are all one sentence synopses. The story is Osiris is flying around, happens to notice that there's an awful lot of Sentinel activity, realizes the Sentinels are digging into Zion, and rushes into the Matrix to dead drop the information before their ship gets blowed up real good.
The end. That's it.
Oh, and then their ship gets blown up real good.
Yeah, it gets blown up real good. Just goes up in flames.
Well, it's certainly not called A Flight of the Osiris. Osiris is the ship, as it turns out.
Fair enough. I don't mind the CGI in this. I actually think it's fine or whatever.
I'm being overly hard on it. It's dated, but it's definitely Japanese CGI of the era. It does look good. It looked good then. It looks fine now, but it's kind of stiff in a weird way. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. Like the lip movement and stuff isn't quite there.
The sexiness isn't quite there in the same way it was.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I'm sure at the time it was like, ooh, you know, especially with that opening sword fighting sequence. But, you know, yeah, it's just not quite there with it. But I do think it's a good introduction to this anthology in terms of like getting you reacclimated to the world of the Matrix and kind of getting you back into it. So I decently like this as a kickoff for it. And it, I don't know, it also seems, I think, a little bit better compared to the next two segments, which are the Second Renaissance Part 1 and Part 2 segments, which we should just talk about together. Because why they're separated in two segments, I guess I don't understand. But
this one was done by Mahiro Maido. And not sure who animated this one offhand, but this one was not written by the Wachowskis. It was based on a story by the Wachowskis. The court case that kind of kicks off the revolution that Matt's about to talk about is detailed from a different angle in the original Matrix comics.
Yeah. Yep. And it's interesting because that's how this short serves. Is basically it's a preamble to everything that were hinted at in The Matrix, when Morpheus is kind of telling the story about the rise of the machines and how humanity is the one that scorches the sky. This kind of goes into the events that lead up to it, including how the machines start to become sentient. We start to distrust the machines, and then we basically do like, you know, humanity likes to do with everything we don't understand, and that is try to destroy it. So it's an interesting kind of history lesson in how history repeats itself. I don't necessarily love this segment because it does come off very dry. Now, it does have some interesting elements to it. including some very famous voice actors that I was privy to because of my girlfriend, who decided to let me know that there was a very famous narrator for this, is one of the famous voice actors from Tekkaman. So we got to love that. So so there's some interesting elements to that. There's some interesting visuals to it, including like the scorching of the sky has this really foreboding use of animation in it. As it plays out almost like a newsreel at time, I got a lot of kind of Verhoeven vibes, especially with some of the ads that were coming in, that I think is really interesting. So I think that there's some interesting stuff in here, but it's a little dry for me.
Weird piece of trivia: the guy that wrote and directed this segment did the art design for Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, no shit, really?
No shit.
That's cool. I didn't know that.
Right? It doesn't have much to do with anything, but I mean, the look, it makes sense. It totally tracks, actually, given how this looks.
It actually
looks.
Totally tracks, yeah. Especially because, like, in this, it's kind of indicated. Because,
like, when that robotic, like, Centurion is running across the field of corpses and stuff, it's really.
Yep, during the war that kind of breaks out.
Also, spoiler alert, everything's humanity's fault and we totally suck.
Yeah, I mean, duh. Like, did you need to tell me that? No, that's exactly how it works. But I don't know. What did you think overall for the segment?
I think that it's interesting in a lore sense. And I really actually think the animation in this is quite gorgeous. But if we're frank, like in a pure pacing way, this is 20 minutes of documentary footage.
Right. And it almost like if you're going to split it into two parts, put the second part later.
Yeah.
Like, you know, for that pacing reason for the film itself.
Because back to back, it's a lot.
It is a lot. And so, like, I would have been much more appreciative had it been kind of split up a little bit.
Does have a really, really good track by Meat Beat Manifesto, though.
Oh, some of the music in this is fantastic. I saw Junkie XL does music in this, too. Mm-hmm. I don't know what segment he did. I just saw his name attached to it, so I thought that was pretty cool. So
next up would be Kid Story, written by the Wachowskis. Animated by Studio 4C and directed by a name a few people might actually know, Shinichiro Watanabe, creator of Cowboy Bebop.
Oh, I didn't know that either. That's awesome.
He has he has two segments in this, and I'll touch on the next one when we get there. But
okay, this one is also like really unique in terms of its animation style.
This feels rotoscoped, and just to touch on it, I actually think it is rotoscoped, in fact, but just real quick, basically is about a kid who is searching for what is the Matrix, gets contacted by Neo, believes in Neo so deeply that when he gets chased by agents in his school for, you know, knowing, because they're after people who are waking up, decides to throw himself off the roof of the school in what I'm going to go ahead and say is an ill-advised move in reality. But his belief is so strong that he actually transubstantiates himself. He wakes himself up without needing a red pill, basically.
Yeah.
Which is... It makes for kind of a cool story, especially in the grander... One thing we should have touched on a little earlier. The grandest theme of The Matrix is belief. And not in a religious way, just believing in an idea so strongly that it empowers you. Why is Morpheus the only character in the Matrix besides Neo to have any success fighting an agent twice? Because his belief is so strong that it actually powers him in the Matrix. Because it's the mind. The mind is your strength.
Right. And I think this one's a really interesting story because I do really like the self-substantiation, as you noted in it, with how it kind of ends and whatnot. It's also one that really utilizes a hot button topic, which is the radicalization of young men online. You know, which is a hot button topic because it's notoriously done in kind of a negative light, obviously, because it's real in terms of the radicalization and the creation of terrorists in a way. But in this, obviously, in this one, we believe in the source or whatever so that it doesn't seem so negative. But I think that that's really interesting because it really shows it in a way that is impactful. It's shown in a negative light, and there was a TV show, it was on Hulu, Monsters, now I can't think of it, where the second episode was about the radicalization of a young man who starts to believe in shadow monsters that are ruining his life. And I think that that's another kind of TV episode of something that you could watch that's very similar to this. But I actually really like this one. I think this one, even the animation style, kind of gives it almost this feel to it. And obviously, as you mentioned, this one is directly connected to The Matrix Reloaded. The kid actually shows up in The Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions as a character that you get to see kind of throughout, a small character throughout it, who references Neo being able to one who kind of woke him up. So I think that that's a kind of a cool connection too.
All right. And actually, totally agree. I actually think Neo's kind of an unreasonable dick to the kid throughout the movies.
Oh, totally is.
Especially, I mean, this is a dude that literally woke himself up. There should be a little more reverence to that. Neo didn't do that.
No. Yeah, it is what.
I can see someone not digging the animation style of this. It's definitely a little fast and loose and Bakshi-like, but I love it.
Yeah, I actually do too. I think this is one of the stronger segments in this anthology. And of course, that leaves us next to the next one, which is one called Program, which has really strong contrasting animation to it, about a young female warrior fighting against a samurai in a time period which is revealed to be a Matrix program, and a test that she is meant to pass.
Or what I like to call the biggest dick move in all of this franchise.
Yep. It's a
loyalty test at that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and when she, you know, when she wakes up, she just cold cocks him too. So that's always good.
Without spoiling my list too far later, this is probably one of the weakest segments, story wise, but visually absolutely gorgeous. It plays out as a samurai battle within a simulation of the Matrix, directed by the famous director of Ninja Scroll.
Yeah, and this one looks like
absolutely
that.
Looks like Ninja Scroll. It's his style animation. Through and through.
Yeah, and it's also the animators for this one, because I looked this one up because I'm a big fan of that director and Ninja Scroll, which is actually I just watched this last year.
Yoshiaki Kawajiri by name.
Okay, that's his name. I can't pronounce it. You know me in Japanese names.
That's why I'm jumping in to just help out.
Thank you. No. So, but I noticed that the studio that did this, whatever Madhouse.
Wait, say Kayako for us real quick.
I'm sorry. Agent K.
Yeah, there you go.
that's as far as I'm getting. No, I noticed that this the studio that did this also, not only did Ninja Scroll, did like Wicked City, Perfect Blue, Millennium Actress, which are all like some of my favorites.
Oh, Madhouse. Yeah. Trigun. Off the top of my head is what I know him for, but yeah.
Yep. Perfect Blue is like one of my favorite films of all time.
As it should be.
As we've talked about on this podcast before. So I actually do enjoy this one, though. I think the action is really good to it. I love the visual style of it. And I do love kind of this idea of like that the Matrix programs that you create, even though we see it in the Matrix, are always kind of like 1999 era programs. I love this idea that the programs would be of different eras. And I think that introduction to that makes a really bold move to say, like, it is the Matrix. Like, what if there's different levels to it, right? Like, it's not just an urban cityscape of 1999. And I think that's kind of a fun addition to it.
So, going ahead to, by the same director, although you wouldn't know it from the animation style, World Record.
It's the same studio, though, right? It's still Madhouse?
Yeah,
it's just...
actually, technically, it's a different director. Director kind of dictates the style. It's the same writer.
Okay.
But the director of the segment's mostly only known for this. He's mostly a character designer, it looks like. No, he did a couple of Lupin the Third movies. That's cool. Good for him.
Well, I'm all about that.
I like me some Lupin the Third. So
me too.
This one.
Let's do that franchise.
I would love to do Lupin the Third.
All 67. Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of movies.
Let's put a pin in that one. Boy, it's not even getting and into the series. None of them are
connected.
It's been running since like the
60s. Yeah.
Anyway, all right. Back in. World Record is basically about a runner who runs so fast that he wakes himself up. And that is really kind of basically it. And it's the shortest, simplest synopsis I could possibly give for what is like one of the coolest and most beautiful stories in it. I like the art style. I could see why someone wouldn't. And if I have to point out any one thing, it is that it has got the greatest dude talking with his hands animation in history with this athlete's coach telling him not to run. Yeah. It's amazing. He's just like, you can't go. It'll snap your legs. What are you doing? You'll end your career.
Yeah. And for the listeners out there, Sean was just flailing his arms wildly. But you're absolutely right. This one's a weirdly character-driven. I mean, a lot of them are character-driven, but this one feels like it's the most like defined in the character-driven, except for maybe Kid's Story. Mm. Kind of really focusing on that. I also like that the agents look different in this, which again, like since you're giving for lack of a better term, agency to these studios to kind of do what they will with it. I like that the agents look a little bit different because, again, that would indicate that, you know, maybe not all the agents in the Matrix all look like they do.
They have
in the
some degree
that
of choice, or maybe it's regional because it's implied
regional,
it's a whole world.
Right. And that this idea that there would be ones that fit into the culture that are around it or something to that effect, even though these ones look even more cyberpunk than you would expect. But, you know, I like that idea. And I think that that's a really cool idea in this one, too.
So,
but I actually agree with the animation.
I also love the ambiguous ending of this one. You don't know if he wakes up or not, and I kind of like that.
Yeah, with him in the wheelchair mm-hmm. and everything. Yeah, it's fantastic. It's a short, sweet, but really, really effective
Sit
one.
Sit down. So good. That's actually so good. Really good.
And then, of course, moving into the next segment, we are talking about Beyond, which is the one that you had mentioned before about the haunted house. It is about a young woman who goes looking for her lost cat, kind of uncovers these kids playing in a so-called, and I'm putting air quotes around this, haunted house that is technically a glitch in the Matrix. And it is like a program that has failed to run properly and it has to be kind of cleaned up. And so you get to see these like glitch cleaners that come in to clean up this glitch. Now, this one is also one that seems pretty vague.
Mm-hmm. Definitely implied that they glitch clean the girl's cat.
Yes, they do. And also, like, there's a lot of interesting elements to this, like how gravity doesn't work in this mm-hmm. house. It doesn't work quite right or things like that. And then, you know,
time's
the ending,
a little funny. And
Yep. Time's a little funny. And the ending does have this really like artistic thing with the blood dropping onto the ground mm-hmm. and this long take of that where you're like, that means something, doesn't it? Or does it? I don't know.
Without spoiling it, this is not only my favorite segment in this. This is just flatly one of my favorite animated shorts ever made, period. And this is kind of what we were talking about in this. You could not know anything about the Matrix. The cleaners kind of resetting the glitch would come off very, very weird, but no weirder than some of the more esoteric Japanese stuff I've seen. And just purely as an animated short about some kids that find a haunted house and have a little adventure, and then there's some spooky government agents that cover it up. It's really quite fun and kind of whimsical and beautiful and haunting.
Am I the only one that got a little bit of a Studio Ghibli feel for this
one? A little bit, right?
Yeah, with the
feather floating in the air. And
yeah, like there's just kind of a fun thing. I actually fully agree with you. I think this is one of the better ones in it, even though it's one of the ones that almost has the least amount of like.
Oh, it's got nothing to do with nothing.
Yeah, but I kind of, again, I like the idea of like.
It's like a slice of life kind of. Yeah.
Yeah, of the Matrix. And I kind of like that. There's a fantastic sound design in it and a real subtle build to how it ends and things like that. So I think that this one is a lot of fun. Mm-hmm.
And then we go to the other Shinichiro Watanabe. That would be the Cowboy Bebop guy. Short, A Detective Story, which is a straight-up noir set in the Matrix, about a detective hired to find Trinity, and then he finds out that the people that hired him suck, like any good noir story, and he helps Trinity escape and dies badly, like any good noir story.
Yeah, for sure. Notable about this one is the noir element to it, but it's the visual style.
It's like a cool black and white. It's kind of staticky or film grainy. It's really cool.
It looks like newspaper mm-hmm. print.
And red's the only color.
A little bit of red in it and things like that. I love that his computer is a typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of interesting visual elements at play in this story.
Yeah, it's a little more steampunky than cyberpunk, this one.
Yeah. It's a very old-fashioned stuff in it. It also features a cat that throws him his hat.
Mm,
which is amazing.
Which is, 5 out of 5 stars.
And a sequence on a train.
Yeah, and a sequence on a train, yeah. 5 out of 5 stars, would watch again.
You do love cats.
That's what we have with that. Yeah, I do love cats. It's kind of how this works. This one's not my favorite. I feel like there's a lot of interesting elements to it. I actually kind of don't like that it's Trinity in this. Mm. I feel like that's kind of ham-fisted into we have to get this character that's there. And I think it's just quick form to get the audience on board that, this person's not bad.
Although it's the one time we see Trinity called the Red Queen, which totally justifies that really neat little spike in the Matrix 4 trailer.
Yeah.
So I'll take it.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
It's kind of funny because it shows that it is specifically Trinity that is the one that is so freaking obsessed with Alice in Wonderland. I think if there's anything that's kind of fun about this to learn about Trinity, that's kind of a cool detail.
Yeah. That's hers. So I wish this one went a little bit further with some of its stuff. It does play out pretty straightforward.
If there's any one of these I would have liked to see extended into a whole movie. Like I said, I love Beyond, but Beyond is great because it's a short. I wouldn't want that to be much longer. This, right. I would watch a whole movie of this.
Oh, for sure. And that's actually, I think, my biggest complaint about it is I was like, I want more.
Mm-hmm.
I want more of this because this is a really interesting idea. I just don't feel like it's quite built out the way that I wanted it. So.
And then we're going to talk about the most polarizing, although for the record, I'm a huge Peter Chung fan, a Korean-American animator best known for, of course, Aeon Flux.
Yep. This is Matriculated, which is a story about a group of scientists in the future Earth who take robots and then put them into the Matrix.
Also, the longest sequence of all of them. Figure that one out.
Yeah. Oh, it's super long. Mm-hmm. And put them into the Matrix and essentially give them agency.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly these robots can kind of choose for themselves, just like the people do in the Matrix, which is a fascinating approach to the material.
Mm-hmm.
It's also very polarizing.
Well, Peter Chung's animation style in and of itself is always going to be polarizing, first and foremost. But this is also kind of the most abject horror story in that what happens is they do turn this robot, but in the course of it, the robot falls in love with one of the resistance fighters and manages to save her once they all get massacred by sentinels, and jacks himself and her into this construct program where she's going to be stuck until she dies, or maybe she's immortal. It doesn't work like the normal Matrix. It's not like super clear, but it's when she wakes up in VR, she's not like super thrilled.
Yeah. I fully agree with this. This one has a lot of interesting gray areas that it plays with. It's also super psychedelic in a lot of its visuals, very particularly trippy. Yeah, and especially when the robot gets first jacked into the Matrix.
Because they're showing how humanity's fun, and they're showing them stuff like games and copulation.
Yeah, fun.
Fun.
Fun. And it is really long, and obviously, as you said, it kind of ends on a pretty dour note, which is really interesting in that aspect of it, and certainly up for debate on what that actually means in terms of things. But this one is not my favorite.
Mm.
I do think it's a little long in the I'm not a huge fan of psychedelic imagery. I think it's fine in small doses, but this segment is a lot of it, and it drags for me a little bit. So
I disagree, but I also have very high tolerance for Peter Chung fuckery. I also really, really like, he does a very, very strange, weirdly long animated series about Alexander the Conqueror called Rain that's equally polarizing. Let me put it that
equally
way.
Equally.
I like it, but
even Aeon Flux, I was not
a huge fan, super hit and miss.
So I think that was just me. His style is just not something that computes with me, if you will.
It's very
So
anorexic, his
he's
style.
very yes, it is. He's not thin on style. His style is just thin. So
So let us. Well, I think.
any last things about the Animatrix as a whole?
I think as a marketing ploy, it is kind of brilliant, and I think that this ended up so much better than it could have. There was, especially at this time, since this was such an experiment with this, this could have been straight to VHS Disney sequel so easily, and the fact that it did something so bold and interesting, I will always appreciate.
Yeah, I fully agree. I love that it's canon. I love that the Wachowskis treat it as canon. I think it is a great
Yeah,
marketing ploy.
every franchise set they've ever put out, this is in there. That's absolutely
It's
true.
yep, the My Box set has it in it as a standalone film. It's not a bonus feature. It's not anything like that. It is a standalone film. I think that that's super cool. I actually do think it's way better than it has any right to be. And it also kind of gives me the taste of what I want from the Matrix franchise. It's the Matrix franchise, I kind of feel the same way, and we're gonna get a lot of hate mail over what I'm gonna say next. But it's a lot like the Star Wars franchise to me, in that Star Wars desperately needed to get the hell away from the Skywalkers. And part of me, as much as I'm excited for the Matrix Resurrections, kind of just wants Neo's story to be done. Like, I kind of want that to be done. I want to explore this universe. You set up all this great universe work. Let's explore it. And I love that about the
I remember
Animatrix.
when everybody was just like, oh, they're gonna try and get a cameo from Keanu. And I was like, eh, that's kind of annoying. And then that you find out like the movie centered on Keanu, and I'm like, what are we doing? I mean, you know what? Lana Wachowski is absolutely doing the movie herself. More power to her. Tell the story you want to tell. But from the outside, I'm like, what are you thinking?
Oh, for sure. I'm the same way. I watched that trailer. That trailer is visually stunning for The Matrix Resurrection.
For
It
such an
also ha
overused song, it works so goddamn well.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And on top of that, it really goes back to that mystery of the original one built on and the marketing for what is The Matrix. And they're kind of building this mystery even with a trailer that's like, what is happening? Like,
Yeah.
we don't understand. That story was done, right? So what is this? Which is both frustrating and intrinsically fascinating to me. Like, I'm hooked.
Plus, people like Neil Patrick Harris, so that's always going to get some brownie points with some people.
Oh yeah, and the guy that plays King George from Hamilton. When he showed up, I was like, oh, that's super funny. I'm game, I'm
It's
in.
so cool.
So, but nonetheless, we'll talk a little bit more about the Matrix Resurrections and what we want from it in terms with our next episode when we cover the Matrix 2 and 3. But for now, let's wrap up this
Quick
episode.
little bonus question, because you made the Matrix Star Wars comparison right when I was about to interject with this question anyway, so very funny. We've now seen this anime concept go wrong a few times. What do you think about them trying to do it with Star Wars right now? You've heard about this, right?
Oh, absolutely. Watch the trailer for it, and I'm 120 fucking percent game.
Anime and
I'm
Star
in.
Wars is like peanut butter and chocolate. How has that never been done before? Like, I'm burnt out on Star Wars and a deep advocate of Disney actually pulling back, just doing the Mando, maybe one cartoon, and letting Star Wars chill for a while. And even being strongly of that opinion, I'm all in on Visionaries. That is such a cool fucking idea. Oh my God.
Yep, I'm 100% in. I'm all on board for this. I think, again, it was my complaint about Star Wars is that let us explore this universe. I think The Mandalorian is incredible for doing that, even though they're starting to tie in the stupid Skywalker saga. Anyway, whatever, we'll get to that later. But they're starting to tie in too much stuff. Just let it be. Like, do your own story, do your own thing over in this corner of the galaxy. But I'm game for it. In fact, I would be game for a lot of these different franchises that world built. You know what? If you wanted to give me a Kingsman his anime anthology or whatever, I'd be fucking down for that too. So like, because you get to explore it in these like little vignettes or whatever
I
in these
would
like 20 minute
say
episodes.
Marvel, but they actually did try that. It was really bad.
And I mean, they're just asking the important questions like, what if, Sean? What
Oh
if?
no. I love What If. No, this is actually true. Turn of the century, like 2003 roundabouts. God, it might even be more recent than that. Maybe it was just 2010s. But they had a deal with Madhouse, and there were 4 or 5 full Marvel anime series produced. It was Wolverine, X-Men, Blade, and Iron Man all have full anime series.
Yeah, and I feel like there's even a newer one than that, right? That went to Netflix or something?
Yeah, I also think there's like a weird Pokemon one where they play like Avengers card game or some shit. Like, anime is very strange.
Yeah, well, but that's a whole different world that we can get into later once we pull out a franchise. All right,
we should get back to the Matrix.
Let's get back. Yeah, we're going down our own rabbit hole here.
Speaking of rabbit holes, yeah, no kidding.
God damn it. All right, let's get to our list. Let's get to our last segment for the episode. And this is a segment that we like to call For Your Lists Only. All right, Sean, and for your list only this time, we're going to keep it simple. We're going to rank the segments of the Animatrix just to see what you have to put in the ranking. Now, you're welcome to rank it backwards to forwards, forwards to backwards. No judgment here, but I would love to hear what you think you would rank the segments for the Animatrix.
I'm going
to
focus on positivity this time, and since I already kind of gave away the ghost anyway, there's no point in hiding it. So with a bullet, Beyond is my favorite. That one is just so cool. Much as I don't like haunted house stories, there's something about a cool whimsical haunted house coming of age story in the Matrix that worked for me.
That's fair.
So it's gonna be Beyond, then Detective Story, then Matriculated. I love weird psychedelic shit, and you know that. So I really like World Record would be next. Kid's Story, I know that's kind of low, but Second Renaissance, Final Flight of the Osiris, and then Program is kind of where I land on it. Final Flight of the Osiris is just kind of a lot of nothing, and we have to talk about Enter the Matrix in a second, so go ahead and do your ranking, because I will end that on how Enter the Matrix is also kind of a fluffy nothing.
Yeah, it's true. All right, my rankings for the Animatrix, number one is the same as yours, Beyond. Big fan of that one. I love that one. I do love the whimsical nature of it. So Beyond is my number one. My number two is Program. I know you don't like that one, but I am a sucker for a good Chambara kind of anime, so I'm all about it. So there's that. Number three is Kid's Story for me. Number four is World Record. Number five is A Detective Story. Number six is The Last Flight of Osiris. Seven is Matriculated, and 8 is Second Renaissance. I like my stuff a little bit more
with things happening
versus history. Yeah. So it's also the reason I'm not a huge fan of the Lord of the Rings books.
It is kind of a lore exposition dump, admittedly.
Yeah. So that one's my least favorite, simply because of that. I wanted more of a story, less of a textbook. So that is our rankings for the Animatrix. That is for your lists only. All right, Sean, you wanted to talk about, I know our episode is running a little long, so let's cap this off and talk about Enter the Matrix.
So I think as a marketing idea, it was really, really cool. As a game, it does not hold up at all. It's a terrible, terrible garbage game that barely controls. But the thing that kind of annoys me about it is they market it really hard as the essential story of Niobe and Ghost and like what they're doing the whole time Matrix Revolutions is going. And like the idea of is that they pick up the package from the Final Flight of the Osiris and they bring it to the captain's meeting and bring this whole thing to everyone's attention. And then throughout the movie, you know, without spoiling our next episode or anything, but throughout the movie, basically Niobe and Ghost show up and, you know, they save Morpheus during the car chase, and they're the team that blows up one of the power stations during that thing. The thing is, for as essential as the game, air quotes, was supposed to be, end air quotes, you look at it and it's basically a series of, oh, and this is how Niobe got there in the freeway. She drove. Oh, and this is how Niobe blew up the power station. She fought her way into the power station and blew it up real good. It's fluff. It's complete fluff.
Yeah, it's unnecessary for sure, although it is considered canon. It is canon, even by the filmmakers.
Has actual film sequences that are unique to it, in fact.
Yep, absolutely. And I will say that the gameplay, although clunky at the time, I played the shit out of this game. I loved it when it came out. Going back to play it.
It predated putting the camera on the second stick. Camera was automatic.
Yep. So it's got its problems, but especially if you try to go back and play it. It's like playing the original Resident Evil again.
Oh, but I played the crap out of this thing when it came out. I did the little hacking mini game, got myself the katana, whole nine.
Yeah, the whole nine yards. I was the same way. I did enjoy this game when it came out, but you're absolutely right in terms of canon. It is canon, but it is quite a bit of fluff. So it is necessary to bring it up if we're going to talk about this franchise, because it is directly connected to the franchise as a storytelling aspect, which is also part of what is really cool about The Matrix. And part of me hopes that they could not remake this game, but make a new one, because mm-hmm. I think they could make it real fucking good now.
And next week, We're talking about the one you liked, because next week we're going to talk about Path of Neo, which is the one I liked.
I'm sorry, what game was that?
The Matrix, The Path of Neo.
Oh, see, I'm not remembering. I'm not remembering, Sean.
You see, there's this Galactus-sized agent. You know what, I'll tell you.
You know what, we'll talk about it next episode. We're running long. All right. And that's kind of how this works, guys. So stay tuned. Check us out next week. We will be covering The Matrix 2 and 3, a.k.a. The Matrix Reloaded and The Matrix Revolutions, to finish off this series before the new Matrix drops this December, which we will have an update for you probably in January when that movie comes out, since it's dropping around Christmas. So, but nonetheless, hopefully you enjoyed this episode. Please check us out on our social medias. You can reach us at our Facebook group, facebook.com/nofranchisefatigue. You can reach us over at Twitter at NFFpod. That's our handle over at Twitter. And then, of course, you can always reach Sean. Sean, where can they email you? It's been so long, I don't even remember your email.
Yeah, no kidding, right? Well, for our new listeners and old listeners alike, they can always reach me at nffpod.sean@gmail.com. That's S-E-A-N. My name is a four-letter word.
That's right. I forgot that you always say that at the end of that, as a four-letter word. And then, of course, you can always reach me over at Twitter at TheMovieMatt, M-O-V-I-E-M-A-T-T. I'm also a four-letter word, Sean. And then, of course, if you want to email me, you can also email me at nffpod.thematrixhasyou. Please wake up. Can somebody get me out of this green screen bullshit? @gmail.com. So you can reach me there for that. We need to make t-shirts of our email addresses.
Now I'm absolutely determined for us to do episode on the Dungeons and Dragons film franchise, just so I can force you to be like, that is Matt, short for Tiamat, because that's a Dungeons and Dragons joke.
That is a Dungeons and Dragons joke, and it took me a minute to remember that there was more than one Dungeons and Dragons movie. And is that because
I think almost all of them are straight to DVD? It's another Scorpion King. Yeah,
I kind of forgot that. I knew they're making a new one that has like Chris Pine in it and stuff.
Well,
so
the first one had goddamn British guy, whatever.
Jeremy Irons.
Yes, Jeremy Irons in it.
Yeah.
Yep. When he was still legitimate, even.
Yeah, when he was a Oscar baby kind of a mm-hmm. actor. No, that is, I forgot about that. Is In the Name of the King?
That part is of not that? Dungeons and Dragons, but that is a video game movie directed by Uwe Boll and weirdly starring Jason Statham.
Yep, and they made like four of those. God. Three of those? Four of those?
Oh, yeah, that franchise was evergreen for him because he could go out in the German countryside and make them for fucking nothing.
Yeah, I was just give a guy a fake sword and call it good. Yeah. So.
Well, we really should do a special episode on the career of fucking Uwe Boll sometime, because that story's you know his entire deal was tax scheme, right?
Oh, that's what I've heard.
Like,
but
literally, his career is the producer's movie, but actually.
Well, and if we wanted to go back to one of our old segments where we talk about a director in Good, Bad, Weird, Wild, we could certainly do one and throw it up at the Patreon for our franchisees.
See if anyone bites, would you guys like that? What do you think?
Yeah, let us know if you guys if you would like to see us kind of bring that segment back or anything. We would love to throw up. We're going to throw up some special episodes anyway over at the Patreon. So definitely let us know if that's something you would like to see. And obviously, let us know if there's any franchises you would like to see too. And just hit us up on our social media for that. Email us. Just let us know. We've got a huge list of requested franchises for us to cover that we will just slowly get through as we go. So, but nonetheless, thank you guys for listening so much. Definitely check us out. We can't wait to hear from you, and stay tuned. Next week we will be going back into the Matrix to cover Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions. All right, thank you guys for listening, as they always say, guns, lots of guns.